Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
You're good to be here.
So today, we're really rolling up our sleeves. We're tackling a topic that honestly, on paper, it sounds a little intimidating.
It's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? Statistical inference for bivariate regression.
It is. It sounds incredibly dry.
Yay.
But as I was going through the source material for this, I started realizing this is actually the secret sauce.
It really is.
This is the machinery behind almost every scientific claim, every economic forecast, every, you know, medical study you read about in the news.
That is exactly right. I mean, if the first part of regression, what we call estimation, is about drawing a map.
Right, drawing the line through the data points.
Then inference is about figuring out if that map actually matches the territory, if it's real.
We've spent time before talking about how to draw that best fit line.
Yeah.
You know, you say, okay, as houses get bigger, they seem to get more expensive. But today is about the step that comes after that. It's about that anxiety, I guess.
The anxiety, yeah. How do you know you can trust it?
Exactly. How do we know that line isn't just a fluke, a coincidence in the specific data we happen to grab?
And that's the whole game. Estimation is finding the pattern in the data you have in your hands right now. Inference is deciding if that pattern applies to the data you don't have.
It's a leap, then.
It's the leap from the specific sample you're looking at to the general population of the world. And that leap, it can be pretty dangerous.
Dangerous because we could be completely wrong.
Precisely. We could be seeing a mirage in the data.
So we've got a massive stack of notes here, all based on a really comprehensive chapter on regression inference. We're going to break down the math, the logic, and, you know, the common pitfalls.
And to keep it grounded, we're going to stick to one case study.
Right. So we're not just floating around in abstract Greek letters. We're going to be talking about house prices.
It's a great example. We have a data set to anchor us. It's actually a pretty small one. Our sample size, what we call $9, is just 29 observations.
29 houses.
Yep. And we're looking at their price versus their size in square feet. And the whole mission today is to move beyond just calculating a number and actually testing a hypothesis about it.
Okay, let's unpack that mission first. Because I think people, and I'll include myself here, often confuse finding a correlation with proving a relationship.
It's very common confusion.
So what's the central question we're really trying to answer today?
The central question is about the reliability of the slope we find. So in our sample of 29 houses, we run the regression, we draw the line, and we find a slope. We see that for every extra square foot, the price goes up by about $73.
Okay, so that's our estimate. We call that 2B2 dollars.
That's our 2B2ler. It's $73.77, to be precise.
That feels like a hard number. It's right there on the computer screen.
It's on the page, absolutely. But the real question is, does that relationship exist in the total population of all houses? Or did we just happen to pick 29 houses that look that way by pure random chance?
It's like the difference between saying, hey, these 29 people I just met today all seem to like pizza, and saying, all of humanity likes pizza.
That is a perfect analogy. And this gets us right to the fundamental problem with samples. We have to make a clear distinction between the sample regression line,
which we write as B1 plus B2XC.
Right. And the true population model, the truth of the universe that we can never actually see. And that's written as beta 1 plus beta 2x plus u.
I want to pause on that notation because it's so important. The sample, our messy human attempt, uses the English letter bottler.
Yes.
The population, the divine truth, uses the Greek letter beta.
Beta.
It's a convention in statistics, yeah. Greek letters are for the true unknowable parameters of the universe. English letters are for our best guess based on the data we have.
And in that population equation, there's that little troublemaker at the end, the letter tall.
It's the error term, the noise, everything else we didn't measure. In a perfect world, if we knew the true betas, we'd know the exact relationship. But because every single sample we take includes some random noise, that different samples are going to give us different estimates for beta.
So if I went out and grabbed a different set of 29 houses from the same city, and I ran the exact same math,
you would not get 73.77.
I wouldn't.
I mean, it's astronomically unlikely. You might get 68 or 80, maybe 74.2.
Why?
Because the specific houses you picked have their own quirks, their own randomness. Maybe one has a brand new kitchen. Maybe another is next to a noisy highway. That's the noise, and it tugs on the regression line every time.
So inference is basically figuring out if the number we got, our 73.77, is a strong enough signal to be heard over all that noise.
That is the goal. We're trying to determine if our variable house size truly affects the outcome price, or if the pattern we see is just a ghost in the machine.
And to do that, we need a yardstick. We need some way to measure the fuzziness or the wobbliness of our estimate.
We do. And that yardstick is what we call the standard error.
Okay. The standard error of the slope coefficient. Let's really dig into this because this noise concept feels a bit abstract.
Mm.
We have a slope 73.77. That's a hard number. It feels solid. But you're telling me it's fuzzy.
It is incredibly fuzzy. And this is genuinely the hardest thing for our brains to accept. We see a number on a printout and our brain immediately thinks, fact.
Right.
But statistically, that 73.77 is not a fact. It is a guess. A very educated guess, but still a guess.
It's a guess based on the 29 houses we just happened to pull out of the hat.
Exactly. So the million-dollar question, and in real estate, it's literally a million-dollar question, is how much do we expect that guess to bounce around? If I were to do this study 1,000 times with 1,000 different samples, how wide would the spread of my results be?
And we need a single number to measure that bounce.
We do. We need a unit of measurement for uncertainty, and that is the standard error.
I've always liked the name standard error because it sounds like a mistake. Oh, sorry, boss, I made a standard error today.
It does sound like that.
But it's actually a measurement. How should we visualize it?
Think of it as a measure of precision. Or, if you want a good analogy, think of it as the average amount we expect our estimate to be off by.
Oh.
Imagine you're shooting arrows at a target. The estimate is where your arrow actually lands. The standard error is the size of the wobbly circle your hands make while you're trying to aim.
So if I'm a terrible archer, my hands are shaking all over the place.
Right. You take one shot, it lands on the outer ring. You take another shot, it hits the dirt next to the target. The spread of your arrows is huge. That's a large standard error. It means any single one of your shots doesn't really tell you much about where the bullseye actually is.
But if I'm an Olympic archer,
your hands are rock steady. All your arrows form a tight little cluster right in the middle. The standard error is tiny.
So a smaller standard error means steady hands. More precision.
Exactly. Smaller standard errors mean higher precision. Larger standard errors mean more uncertainty. So let's bring it back to our house price data. Our coefficient, the slope $2B2, is $73.77. That tells us for every extra square foot, the price goes up by about $74.
Okay. That's the arrow in the target.
But the computer output also gives us a standard error. And in this case, the default standard error is 11.17.
So we think the price goes up by roughly $74, give or take about $11.
Loosely speaking, that's a great way to think about it. That 11.17 represents the average amount of miss we expect to see just because of random sampling variation.
And the relationship between the estimate and the error.
That relationship between the 73 and the 11 is what drives everything else. It lets us calculate the T statistic.
Ah, the famous T stat. I feel like anyone who's ever taken a stats 101 class remembers looking for the T stat on the printout, even if they completely forgot what it actually meant.
It's the key.
So what's the formula?
It's a ratio, and it's arguably the most important ratio in all of frequentist statistics. The formula is simple. Your T statistic equals your estimate minus your hypothesized value, all divided by the standard error.
Okay, let's break that down. The estimate is our 73.77.
Yep.
The standard error is the 11.1 fippers. What is this hypothesized value?
That's the value we're testing against. And 9 times out of 10, we are testing against 0.
Why 0?
Because testing against 0 is asking the question, is there any relationship at all? If the true slope is 0, it means house size has no effect on price. It's the baseline of nothing is happening here.
So the formula becomes just the estimate divided by the standard error.
For this test, yes. So for our house data, it's 73.77 divided by 11.17.
Which gives us T statistic of 6.6.
6.6.
Is that good? Is that a big number?
It is huge. Think of the T statistic as a signal to noise ratio. The estimate, the 73.77, is the signal. That's the pattern we think we found.
And the standard error?
The standard error, the 11.17, is the noise. That's the random static that's clouding our view.
So we have 6.6 times more signal than noise.
Exactly. As a general rule of thumb in social sciences, a t-stat above 2 is starting to look pretty reliable.
A p-stat of 2 means the signal is twice as loud as the noise.
Right. So a 6.6 is very, very strong evidence that this relationship is real. It's the difference between hearing a shout across a quiet library and trying to hear a whisper in the middle of a rock concert.
Okay, so we have this number, 6.60. But a number is just a number. We have to compare it to something. I remember using these tables in the back of a textbook.
Yes, a distribution table.
We aren't using the normal distribution here, the classic bell curve, are we? We're using something called the student's T distribution. Why is that?
This is a subtle but really crucial point. If And this is a big if we knew the true variance of the errors in the entire population.
So if we knew, like, God's spreadsheet of how much all house prices naturally bounce around.
Exactly. If we had that, we could use the normal distribution. But we don't. We only have our tiny sample of 29 houses.
And we have to use that tiny sample to guess what the true variance is.
Right. We have to estimate the error variance using our sample variance, which we call SERIO2. And because we are using an estimate to help us calculate another estimate, we're introducing an extra layer of uncertainty into the system.
More noise.
We're adding more noise. The normal distribution assumes we know the variance perfectly. Since we don't, we have to use a distribution that's more forgiving, more cautious. And that is the student's T distribution.
What does it look like?
It looks a lot like a bell curve, but it has fatter tails.
Fatter tails? That sounds like a description of my cat. What does it mean for a distribution?
It means that extreme events, outliers, are considered more likely than in a normal distribution. Or, to put it another way, because our information's imperfect, we have to be more open to the possibility that our result is just a weird fluke.
So the fat tails are a buffer, a safety margin.
They are. They effectively say, you need a slightly stronger signal to impress me, because I know you're working with limited information.
And the specific shape of this T distribution, how fat the tails are, depends on something called the degrees of freedom.
It does.
And in our notes, it says for bivariate regression, the degrees of freedom is $1 to $2.
Correct.
I have always wondered this. Why -2? Why not 1 pounder or just 1 tone?
Think of degrees of freedom as your budget of information. You start with long pieces of information, in our case, 29 data points. That's your currency.
Okay, I have 29 information coins.
Now, before you can even start to calculate the variance or the standard error, you first had to draw that regression line.
Right.
And to draw a straight line, you need to estimate two things. The intercept, beta 10 honored, and the slope, beta 2 down.
The starting point of the line and the angle of the line.
Exactly. You had to spend two of your information coins to lock down those two parameters. You used up 2 degrees of freedom just to get the line drawn.
That leaves me with known 10-2 coins, or 27 in this case, to actually estimate the variance.
That's it. And you can see why having a really small sample is so difficult. If you only had, say, 4 data points, and you spend 2 of them just to draw the line,
you've got almost nothing left to judge reliability.
You have very little left. Your T distribution gets really, really fat tails, and it becomes incredibly hard to prove anything is significant.
Okay, so we've got our yardstick, the standard error. We've got our measuring cape, the T distribution with NTERI 2 degrees of freedom. But before we can actually start throwing around confidence levels and p-values, we have to talk about the rules of the road.
Yes. The assumptions.
Because none of this fancy math works if the underlying data is garbage, right? Or if the structure of the data violates certain laws.
We call these the 4 OLS assumptions. If these hold true for a population, our inference is valid. If they don't, we might be lying to ourselves.
Okay, let's walk through them one by one. This is like the constitution for our regression model. What's assumption one?
Assumption one is linearity. The population model is actually linear. We're assuming the true relationship really looks like y equals beta 1 plus beta 2x plus u1.
That seems pretty basic.
It is, but it's often violated. What if the real relationship is a curve? Like maybe super huge houses actually get cheaper per square foot because they're so expensive to maintain.
Right.
If we try to force a straight line through a curved pattern, our inference will be wrong. We're asking the wrong question, so we're bound to get the wrong answer.
Makes sense. Okay, assumption two.
0 conditional mean. This is the big one. This is the one that guarantees our estimators are unbiased.
Mathematically, it looks like U it equals dollar.
It does.
In English, please.
It means that the errors, all those unmeasured things in $100 that make a house more or less expensive than our line predicts, are not correlated with our variable, $6.
Can you give me a real-world example of how this breaks?
Absolutely. Imagine that luxury finishings like marble countertops and gold-plated taps are part of our error term because we didn't include them in our regression.
Okay, they're unmeasured. They're in the noise.
Now here's the question. Do big houses tend to have more luxury finishings?
Of course.
Yeah.
You don't put gold taps in a tiny studio apartment.
Exactly. So as house size goes up, the error also tends to go up. On average, they are correlated. That breaks the assumption.
And what's the consequence?
The regression line gets confused. It sees those really high prices for big houses, and it mistakenly attributes all of that price increase to the size of the house, not the marble floors it doesn't know about.
So it steepens the slope.
It steepens the slope to try and capture that hidden effect. Our estimator, PB2D2$, becomes biased. It's no longer pointing at the true effect of size alone.
Got it. So assumptions 1 and 2 are about hitting the right target. If they hold, our estimate is unbiased on average. What about 3 and 4?
Assumptions 3 and 4 are about the spread of our shots. They're about the variance. Assumption 3 is homoscedasticity.
My favorite word in all of econometrics.
It sounds like a tropical disease, but it's a requirement for the standard formulas to work. It just means constant variance.
Okay.
It implies that the error term, p-day, has the same variance regardless of the value of $6.
So the random spread of prices for small houses is roughly the same size as the random spread of prices for giant mansions.
That is the assumption, yes. You can visualize a tube around the regression line. We assume the data points float randomly inside this tube, and the tube stays the exact same width from left to right.
But does that ever really happen in real life?
Yeah.
Especially with money?
Rarely. It's a very strong assumption. As we just discussed, big houses can have wild price swings. Small houses are usually in a much tighter price band.
So the tube isn't a tube. It's more like a trumpet getting wider and wider.
Exactly. When the tube widens like a trumpet, that's called heteroscedasticity. We'll talk later about how to fix that. But the default math we're doing right now assumes the tube is perfectly straight.
And the last one, assumption 4.
Independence. The error for one observation is not correlated with the error for another observation.
Meaning?
Knowing that house A sold for $10,000 more than we predicted shouldn't give me any information about whether its neighbor, house B, is also likely to sell for more than predicted.
This comes up a lot in time series data, right? Like with stock prices.
Absolutely. If the stock market has a surprisingly good day today, it's probably more likely to have a good day tomorrow, too. The errors are clustered. That violates independence. But for a random sample of houses spread across a big city, the independence assumption usually holds up pretty well.
So let's recap the penalties. If assumptions 1 and 2 fail, what happens?
If 1 and 2 fail, your slope estimate itself is wrong. It's biased. You are fundamentally pointing at the wrong number in the universe.
Okay, that's bad. What if 3 and 4 fail, but 1 and 2 are okay?
This is the key distinction. If 3 and 4 fail, your slope is still correct, on average. It's still unbiased. But your standard error, your measure of precision, your yardstick, is wrong.
So we might be right about the relationship, but we're completely wrong about how confident we should be about it.
Exactly. And that can be just as dangerous. You think you have proof, but you don't.
Okay, let's assume for now that we followed all the rules. The four assumptions hold. The data is good. We have our estimate, 73.77, and our standard error, 11.17. Now we want to present this to the world.
Right.
We don't just want to give a single number because we know it's fuzzy. We want to give a range. We want to build a confidence interval.
This is often much more useful for a reader than a simple yes or no test. A confidence interval gives you a range of plausible values for the true population parameter, DO322.
It's like instead of throwing a dart, we're throwing a net. We're trying to catch the true value. What's the formula for constructing this net?
It's a simple structure.
Yeah.
It's your estimate plus or minus a margin of error.
And the margin of error is?
It's the critical value from our T distribution multiplied by our standard error. So in math terms, it's PLOPM TN2 times CB2L.
Okay, we have the estimate 73.77. We have the standard error 11.17.
Mm-hmm.
We need that critical value. Where does that come from?
It comes from the t-distribution table we talked about, and it depends on how confident you want to be. The industry standard is 95% confidence.
Okay.
So for a 95% confidence level with a sample size of 29, which means 27 degrees of freedom, if you look it up in a table or use software, the critical t-value is approximately 2.052.
So roughly 2. For 95% confidence, it's almost always somewhere around 2, isn't it?
It's a very good rule of thumb, yes. Once your sample size gets above 30 or so, it's very close to 1.96, sure, which people just round it to.
So we take our standard error, 11.17, and multiply it by that critical value, 2.052.
Correct. And that gives us our margin of error, which comes out to about 22.93.
And we add and subtract that from our original estimate.
Exactly. So $73.77, $22.93 gives us 50.84 cents. And $73.77 plus 22.933 gives us $96.70.
So our 95% confidence interval is roughly from 51 to 97. We're telling our audience, our best guess for the price increase is about $74. Per square foot, but we're pretty confident the true value is somewhere between $51 and $97.
Yes, but here, right here is where we have to be very, very careful. There is a massive interpretation trap that catches even experienced PhDs.
Okay, lay it on me. I'm ready.
Yeah.
I want to say There is a 95% probability that the true value is inside this specific interval we just calculated.
And that feels so right, doesn't it?
It feels like that's literally what 95% confident should mean.
It does. But strictly speaking, in the world of classical frequentist statistics, that statement is incorrect.
Why? That's so counterintuitive.
It's a subtle philosophical issue. In the frequentist view, the true parameter, beta 2 theta, the buried treasure we're looking for, is a fixed, constant number. It's not moving. It doesn't have a probability distribution. It's either inside your specific interval or it's outside.
So the probability is either 0% or 100%. We just don't know which.
Exactly. The treasure's just sitting there. The randomness isn't in the treasure's location. The randomness is in your net.
My net. My confidence interval.
Your confidence interval is the net. You constructed it using a random sample of data. If you had gone out and picked a different 29 houses, you would have gotten a slightly different slope, a slightly different standard error, and you would have built a slightly different net. Maybe it would be 60, 100, or maybe 40, 80.
So what on earth does the 95% refer to?
It refers to the reliability of your net throwing method. The correct but very pedantic way to say it is this. If we were to repeat this entire process, gather 100 different random samples, and build 100 different intervals, we would expect 95 of those 100 intervals to successfully capture the true parameter. We are 95% confident that the specific interval we calculated this one time is one of the good ones.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
Yeah.
And it is maddeningly pedantic.
It is, but it matters because it reminds us that the uncertainty is in our sample, not in the truth itself. We are placing our confidence in our procedure, not in this one specific outcome.
Okay, I get it, even if I don't love it. Now, looking at that interval, 51 to 97, that's a pretty wide range. I mean, 97 is almost double 51.
Yeah.
It is, and that width reflects the uncertainty we have from using a small sample of only 29 houses. If we had 1,000 houses in our sample, that standard error would shrink dramatically and the interval would tighten up. Maybe it would be something like 70, 76.
And this brings up the trade-offs, right? If I want to be more confident, say, I want a 99% confidence interval, what happens?
To be more confident that you've caught the fish, you need to use a wider net. You have to expand your bounds. The critical value from the t-distribution goes up, your margin of error gets bigger, and your interval widens. Maybe it becomes 40, 110.
And what if I want the opposite? I want a narrower, more precise interval. I want to really pin this number down.
Then you have to accept lower confidence.
Yeah.
You could calculate an 80% or 90% interval, which would be narrower, but you'd be taking a higher risk, a 10% or 20% risk, that the true value isn't inside your interval at all.
There's no free lunch.
No free lunch. You pay for precision with confidence, and you pay for confidence with precision.
Okay, let's move on to the trial. Hypothesis testing. This is really just another way of using the same math we've already done, but framing it as a guilty or not guilty decision.
Exactly. In this framework, we treat our regression like a courtroom trial. We start with a null hypothesis, which we write as H dollars.
And the null is usually the boring scenario, right?
It's the no relationship baseline. We assume that beta 2 equals is dollars, dollars.
Innocent until proven guilty. We start by assuming that house size has no effect on price whatsoever.
Correct. We assume the defendant, which is our variable house size, is innocent of having any effect on the price. The alternative hypothesis is that beta 2 ender dollars. Something is happening. The defendant is not innocent.
So how do we reach a verdict in this trial?
We look at the strength of the evidence, and the evidence in this case is our t-statistic.
Which we found earlier was 6.60.
A very large t-stat. That's a lot of evidence. Now, there are two common ways to read the verdict from this evidence. The first is the critical value approach. We already found our critical value for 95% confidence. It was 2.052. That's our line in the sand. If the evidence we have crosses that line, we convict.
And our evidence, our t-statistic, was 6.60.
Right. So does the absolute value of 6.60 exceed 2.052?
Easily. It's more than 3 times bigger.
Then we reject the null hypothesis. The evidence is too strong to be consistent with the defendant being innocent. We declare that the variable is statistically significant at the 5% level.
Okay, that's one way. What's the second way? The p-value approach.
The p-value is a slightly different way of thinking about it. The p-value is the probability of observing evidence this extreme, a t-statistic of 6.60 more, if the null hypothesis were actually true.
So it answers the question. If size really didn't matter at all, what are the odds we'd see a pattern this strong just by random fluke?
Precisely. And for our example, the software output says the p-value is 0.0000.
Meaning the probability is basically zero.
Yeah.
Essentially zero. It is incredibly, incredibly unlikely, less than one in a million, that we would see this strong of a pattern by random chance if there was truly no relationship.
So the rule is, if the p-value is low, the null must go.
That's the mnemonic, yes. Since our p-value, 0.000, is much less than our chosen significance level, which is usually 0.05, we reject the null.
So a low p-value means a high level of surprise.
Yes. The data is extremely surprising if you believe the null is true. So you conclude the null is probably not true.
What I really like is how you can connect all of this back to the confidence interval. It's a great visual sanity check.
It is. They are two sides of the same coin. Our 95% confidence interval was 50.84, 96.70. This represents the entire range of plausible values for the true slope.
Right.
Now, just ask yourself a simple question. Is the number from the null hypothesis, which is zero, inside that range?
No, not even close. Yeah. Zero is way outside to the left. The lowest plausible number according to our interval is 50.84.
Exactly. And because zero is not in our plausible range, we reject it as a possibility. It's the same conclusion.
If the interval had been something like negus 10 plus 20, then zero would be right in there.
It would be. And then we couldn't reject it. We'd have to say, well, the data is consistent with the true effect being zero.
That makes it so much clearer. If zero isn't in the net, then zero probably isn't the fish.
Precisely.
Okay. We need to pause here and make a very, very important distinction. We've established statistical significance. We've proven, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the effect is not zero.
Yes.
But that doesn't automatically mean the effect is important, does it? This is the crucial battle between statistical significance and economic significance.
This is where common sense and subject matter knowledge have to enter the room. Statistical significance is purely a mechanical result driven by the t-statistic. And remember, the t-stat is driven by two things: the signal strength, the size of the coefficient, and the precision, which is related to the sample size.
And we know the standard error gets smaller and smaller as the sample size gets bigger.
Correct. So let's imagine a crazy scenario. Imagine we had a data set with 10 million houses. The standard error would be infinitesimally small. We could measure things with atomic level precision.
So what if the true effect of house size on price was minuscule, say 1/10 of 1 penny per square foot?
A meaningless effect. But if we have 10 million houses, we might measure that tiny effect with perfect precision. We might find a coefficient of 0.00011 and a standard error of 0.00001.
The T statistic would be 100.
Exactly. The computer would spit out a p-value with 30 zeros. It would scream, highly statistically significant. It would put three little stars next to it.
But does it matter? If I add 1,000 square feet to my house, which is a massive addition, the price goes up by $1.
Nobody cares. It is completely irrelevant to any human decision making. It's statistically significant because we are very, very sure it's not exactly zero, but it is economically insignificant because the magnitude is trivial.
That's the large sample trap. What about the small sample trap?
That's the exact opposite problem. Imagine we're studying a variable that has a massive real-world impact. Let's say being located in a top-rated school district raises a house's price by $50,000. That's huge.
That's economically very significant.
It is. But what if we only have 20 houses in our sample and the prices are bouncing all over the place for other reasons?
Our standard error on that school district variable might be enormous. Let's say it's $40,000.
So our estimate is 50,000, but our noise is 40,000.
So the T statistic is 50,000 divided by 40,000, which is just 1.25.
That's way less than our critical value of 2, so we fail to reject the null.
The computer says not significant. And a lazy researcher might write, we find no evidence that school districts affect house prices. But they'd be wrong.
They matter a lot. We just didn't have a powerful enough microscope to prove it.
Exactly. We missed a real important effect because our sample was too small and our data was too noisy. So let's bring it back to our house price example. The coefficient is $73.77 per square foot. Is that economically significant? I would absolutely say so. A 100 square foot addition, like a small bedroom, is over $7,300. That's real money. That matters to a homeowner, to a builder, to a buyer.
Right. So in this case, we have both. We have statistical significance. We're sure the effect isn't zero. And we have economic significance. The magnitude of the effect actually matters in the real world. You have to look at both.
Don't just stargaze at the p-values.
Never just stargaze. Look at the coefficient size, the p-value of $2, and ask yourself, is this a number that changes how people behave?
Okay, let's get a bit more advanced. We've been testing against a null of zero. But what if I have a more specific theory? Let's say I read a report from a builder's association that says construction costs are about $90 per square foot. So in a fair market, prices should rise by exactly $90 per square foot.
We can test that. We are not married to testing against zero. We can test against any value we want. This is a two-sided test where the null hypothesis is now $0. Beta 2 equals $9.
So the math for the t-stat changes slightly. We go back to that full formula, text estimate, text hypothesize value.
Exactly. So it's $73.77 in the numerator, all divided by our standard error of 11.17.
That gives us 93.23 on top, divided by 11.17, which is roughly -1.45.
Our new t-statistic is -1.45. Now, we do the same check as before. We take the absolute value, which is 1.45. Is that bigger than our critical value of 2.052? Oh,
it's smaller. It didn't cross the line.
So we fail to reject the null hypothesis.
Wait a minute. But 73 is clearly not 90.
It's not 90. But is it statistically distinguishable from 90 given the amount of noise in our data? The answer is no.
The noise is too loud.
The noise is too loud. 90 is within our margin of error. Remember our confidence interval? It went all the way up to 96.70.
Right. So 90 is comfortably inside the net.
It is. So we can't rule it out as a plausible value. We have to say the data is consistent with the true value being $90.
So we can't prove it is 90, but we can't prove it isn't either.
That's the perfect summary. We lack the statistical evidence to overturn the claim.
Now, what about directional claims? Sometimes you hear people making a one-sided bet. They might say, I guarantee the price increase is less than $90.
That changes the nature of the test. That is a one-sided test. Now, our alternative hypothesis is HA, beta 2, 90-DOR.
Why does that matter for the math?
Because we are no longer looking in both tails of the distribution for a surprising result. In a two-sided test, we split our 5% risk of being wrong. 2.5% chance of being wrong on the high side and 2.5% on the low side.
Okay.
In a one-sided test, we put all 5% of that rejection risk into just one tail. In this case, the left tail, because we're testing less than.
Does that mean the critical value changes?
Yes. It becomes easier to reject the null. The critical value moves closer to zero. For 27 degrees of freedom, the one-sided critical value for a 5% test is about -1.70.
So the hurdle is lower.
The hurdle is lower because we focus all of our attention on just one possible direction of the outcome.
Okay, so our test statistic was -1.45. Is that lower, meaning more negative, than our new critical value of -1.70?
No, it's not. Mengeder 1.45 is closer to zero than Mengeder's 1.70 is.
So even with the lower bar, we still fail to reject.
We do. The p-value for this one-sided test, if you calculate it, is 0.079. That is very close to our 0.05 cutoff, but it's not quite there.
So we can't say with 95% confidence that the true value is less than 90, but 0.079 is pretty low. Could we say it with 90% confidence?
Yes. If we lowered our standards and used a 10% significance level, our p-value of 0.079 would be less than 0.10.
So we could reject the null at the 10% level.
You could. And this highlights just how arbitrary these cutoffs can be sometimes. Whether a scientific claim is declared true or false can often depend entirely on whether the journal you're publishing in uses a 5% or a 10% standard.
Which is why reporting the actual p-value is so useful. It lets the reader decide for themselves where to draw the line.
Precisely.
Okay. Yeah. We have to stop here. Because we spent the last 45 minutes building this beautiful logical cathedral. We have our t-stats, our bell curves, our nice confidence intervals. And it all rests on those four assumptions we listed at the very start.
And specifically, it rests on assumption 3, homoscedasticity, the constant variance.
The tube.
We have been assuming that the error, the random noise, is the same for a tiny little shack as it is for a $10 million mega mansion.
And as we're looking at these notes, that assumption seems, frankly, insane.
It is wildly unrealistic in most economic applications. Think about it. If you were selling a 500-square-foot micro apartment, what's the possible price variance? Maybe $10,000, $20,000. There's only so much you can do to it.
Right. The floor is low and the ceiling is low. The range is tight.
Now think about a 10,000 square foot estate. It could be a dilapidated ruin that's a teardown worth maybe $1 million for the land. Or it could be a pristine architectural marvel with a home theater and a bowling alley worth $20 million. The noise around the predicted price is gigantic.
So the tube isn't a tube. It's a funnel. It's a trumpet getting louder and louder and lighter as the houses get bigger.
Exactly. That is heteroscedasticity. And here's the scary part. If we have that trumpet shape, which we almost always do with economic data, then the standard formula that all basic software uses to calculate the standard error is wrong.
Wrong as in a little bit off. or wrong as in dangerously misleading.
Dangerously misleading. Typically, in the presence of heteroscedasticity, the standard formula underestimates the true amount of noise. It makes us think we are more precise than we actually are.
So we could be walking around with a t-statistic of 6, thinking we've proven our theory beyond a shadow of a doubt, but the reality is that the correct t-statistic is only 1.5.
Precisely. We are generating false positives everywhere. We're seeing ghosts in the data. We are rejecting null hypotheses that should not be rejected.
So what do? Do we burn the cathedral down? Do we throw out the entire OLS model?
We don't have to burn it down, but we definitely have to renovate it. We have to use a solution called robust standard errors. They're sometimes called white standard errors, named after the economist Halbert White, who developed them.
How do they work? What's the logic?
It's a brilliant idea. We keep assumptions 1 and 2, so our slope estimate, our 73.77, doesn't change. It's still the best straight line you can draw through the data points.
Okay.
But we relax assumptions 3 and 4. We use a different, more complicated formula to calculate the standard error one that basically allows each observation to have its own unique level of variance.
It adapts to the fan shape of the data.
It does. It effectively panelizes the observations out on the wide end of the trumpet where there's high variance. It creates a more honest, more conservative assessment of our overall precision.
So let's see how it changes the numbers in our house price example.
Okay. The default standard error was 11.1 sen. The heteroscedasticity robust standard error is 11.33.
That is not a big difference at all. It went up by 16 cents.
In this specific small data set, the difference is trivial. It's a rounding error. The t-stat drops slightly from 6.60 to 6.51. The confidence interval widens by a tiny, tiny bit to 50.33, 97.02. The conclusion remains exactly the same.
House size definitely affects price.
No doubt. But that won't always be the case. In many modern datasets with thousands of observations and complex variables, the robust SEE can be 50% larger or even double the size of the default one. It can be the difference between a t-stat of 3 and a t-stat of 1.5, the difference between getting your paper published and not.
So in modern econometrics, do people even use the default errors anymore?
Almost never in a professional setting. Reporting robust standard errors has become almost mandatory in top journals to avoid the problem of false positives.
It's like wearing a seatbelt. In this short drive with our simple house data, we didn't get into a crash, so it didn't really matter that we were wearing it, but you should always wear it.
That is a perfect analogy. You never know when heteroscedasticity is lurking under the surface. And there are other types of robustness, too. We talked about assumption 4, independence.
Right.
If you have time series data, you use something called HAC errors. If you have data on students clustered within schools, you use cluster robust errors because kids in the same school are not independent observations.
So the key takeaway here is the default output from your computer is not always the truth. You have to stop and ask, are my errors behaving the way the simple model assumes? And if not, do I have the right kind of standard error to fix it?
Precisely. Always check under the hood.
Wow. We have covered a massive amount of ground today. From the basic idea of inference, that big leap from a sample to the whole population, all the way through t-stats, assumptions, confidence intervals, hypothesis testing, and finally, these robust errors.
It really is the full toolkit. It's the bridge that takes you from saying, I see a pattern in my spreadsheet, to being able to say, I am confident this pattern is real.
If you had to summarize this entire journey in one core thought, what would it be?
I would say this. The best fit line, the estimation, tells you what the data says. But the standard error and the t-statistic, the inference, tell you how loud the data is shouting. Without inference, you're just looking at a blurry picture.
Yeah.
With inference, you're measuring the strength of the reality behind that picture.
That's a great way to put it. And I want to leave our listener with a final provocative thought to mull over. We spend a lot of time on the classic assumptions, homoscedasticity, normal distributions, all of that. And then at the very end, we basically said, but actually, just use robust errors because those classic assumptions almost always fail in the real world.
Right.
So here's the question. If robust errors are safer, require fewer assumptions, and work even if the errors are messy, why do we even teach the default ones anymore? Why is the classic model still the default setting in most statistical software? Is it just historical inertia? Or is there some deeper value in learning the rules of a perfect ideal world before we have to confront the messy real world?
That is a deep and difficult question for pedagogy. Perhaps understanding the ideal gives us the baseline we need to understand why the world is messy. You have to understand the rule before you can really appreciate the exception.
Something to think about the next time you see a regression table in a newspaper article or a study. Don't just look for the little stars next to the numbers. Look at the standard errors. Look at the width of the confidence intervals. Ask yourself, how precise is this knowledge, really?
Always question the precision.
Thanks for diving deep with us. We'll see you on the next one.
Goodbye.